Hello and welcome to Reasonably Fit. We're Jason and Lauren Pack, and this is the podcast for anyone who wants a more thoughtful and grounded approach to health and fitness.
Today we have an incredible guest interview with Dr. Dylan Caswell. Dylan is a sought-out, enthusiastic clinical doctor of physical therapy with expertise in a board specialty certification in sports, working with a range of everyday to elite professional athletes. He's spent more than 10 years in higher level education, both as a student and adjunct professor at SUNY Upstate Medical University. He desires to empower and educate the next generation by cutting through the biased lies surrounding the human experience by constantly seeking and delivering the truth in science and healing. This mission has fueled him to write an inspiring book grounded in science called Hope, Not Nope. He sent us an autographed copy. It's so good. We read the whole thing ourselves, and we are so excited about this interview.
I can tell you right now, you are going to love this interview. It is probably one of my favorites to date of the interviews we've done, and the topic is so universal.
Yeah.
Like everyone in life is going to experience some sort of physical discomfort in their joints and their muscles and stuff like that. And this interview and the book, hopefully you get the book, will really help to break down the whole just science behind injuries and the way your brain behaves and your nervous system just operates. And it was a really fascinating book to read, as well as an interview to conduct with Dylan.
I mean, and you say the science behind it, and I think that the initial assumption, if you say the science behind injuries, is like that you're going to look at the spine and each disc and how much space there should be in between. Like, that is not what we're talking about at all. Dylan had he knows all that stuff, which is like cool on its own, right? Like, to know anatomy and to understand how the body works. But the science that you're referring to is really the science of like how our brains interpret pain and how our mindset can actually shift the way that we heal and recover. There's so much more to it than I hurt my back. These are the five exercises I have to do to get better, or I need surgery. Like, it's not just as simple as this is the solution in a physical sense, but there's also an emotional component. There's a mental component that is maybe even more important than the physical component, right?
Yeah, and in the episode, he goes through, I mean, he probably breaks down a whole 15 to 20 minute scenario that you present with, and I won't spoil it now. And I remember you walking him through the scenario, and I was like, wow, I'd be very impressed if he gives a good solution here, because it's so unorthodox specific what happened and whatnot. And then he just proceeds to just step by step talk about how he would approach the patient, which in this case was you. And it was a mind-blowing approach, and it was a masterclass in just how to talk to a patient. And I think just listening to it, I think a lot of you will be like, oh, wow, this is what a good clinician would help me just walk through. Instead of just like, you know, the factories where you just like go in and out, where you're on the exercise bike, then you get some ice and you ultrasound, and then you're out of there without any like talk of like, how are you doing? Like, why is this important to you? What do you want to get back to? Like, what, like, just the whole gamut behind it, not just you being relegated to a sensitive knee or a bad shoulder or whatnot. And it was just a really eye-opening and just really incredible breakdown of what a great physical therapy session should involve and look like.
Yeah, it definitely, I think it will empower people listening to understand what good PT can be, and know and recognize when you might not be getting the right treatment or getting the right, or not even right, but like the treatment that might be able to push the needle forward, or even just make you question if you should get a second opinion or see someone different, or just approach your injury or pain in a different way. Because I think that you can put yourself in my shoes when I tell this story, or put yourself in the shoes of some of the stories that he tells in the episode, and see how things might have been different for you if you had taken a different approach. And hopefully moving forward can have some better tools in your toolbox to deal with injuries and pain, because we're all going to experience them. And it's really a matter of how we approach the process of healing that is going to kind of like make or break where we go from there.
Yeah. When we had our gym, we had a lot of people that would come in with all sorts of different ailments and stuff like that. And I would say a good majority of them would say, because we would be like, you know, a good physical therapist would help you out with this in conjunction with our strength training regimen. And a lot of times they would say, I've tried PT and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And most of the times they've probably been to a place like we were talking about that is kind of like a factory. They're just trying to get in as many patients through the door as possible. And unfortunately, it's a byproduct of the whole insurance system. They have to do things to bill insurance and they have to be a profitable business. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot more cash-based PT businesses pop up, because then they can treat the way that they want to treat. They don't have to justify their treatment methods. Like, you can't bill talking to someone about their goals and their aspirations and what sport they want to get. You're the only thing you can bill for are like very specific modalities like ultrasound or joint manipulations and whatnot. And so you're kind of forced to do those things if you are an insurance-based model, but a lot of these cash-based PTs are opening up. And, you know, I think it's tough because cash-based PTs are obviously going to be more expensive than those that take insurance. But if you are feeling like you've seen multiple PTs and it just hasn't worked, I think it is a worthwhile investment to look into to go for a PT that isn't just completely tied down by their insurance.
Yeah. And the thing is that with the cash-based PTs that we've seen, like, they're not trying to get us to come in for 10 weeks consecutively. Like, yes. They're trying to see us once. Like, mm-hmm. Dylan said that in the episode too. Like, I might see you once or twice a year. Mm-hmm. And that's my goal. Like, I want you to be out there getting better, not just coming into the clinic every week for some ice and e-stim. And yeah. And so it does come down to, like, how much do you value your time? Thinking about if you're gonna eventually, like, potentially go down the road to surgery, things like that, all of that is gonna cost more overall than investing in one or two sessions with a really, really good PT who's gonna give you more than just the standard kind of couple modalities here and there and send you on your way. So it is like, yes, it can be expensive, but sometimes you do have to weigh what is the expense of not doing this.
Yeah, that the time perspective, especially, I feel like the few times I've gone to like a traditional PT clinic, I'm there with a PT aide and they're usually working with four other people. And we're just kind of going through this weird circuit of like exercise bike and to icing and to just kind of like hanging out. And then you see the real PT for like 10 minutes who just does like a little bit of e-stim or like some Graston or some massage work on it. And then you're out the door and you're like, well, that was a whole hour where I saw the person for like 10 minutes and they barely even talk to me, yeah, kind of thing. And so I don't know why this is getting into a tangent on insurance and cash-based PTs and whatnot, but we just want you to know that if you've gone through a few different PTs before, it's not PT that isn't working. It's just the system around that hasn't really been working for you. Mm-hmm. And that there is hope.
There's hope.
There is, exactly, hope, and that there are so many good professionals out there.
Yeah. So we don't want to drag this on for too much longer because we want to get you into the interview with Dylan, but we just wanted to introduce it a little bit because honestly, we're just like on a high from the interview. It was so good. It was so good. So we can't wait to share it with you. So please, without further ado, enjoy Dr. Dylan Caswell.
Whoop.
All right, Dylan, welcome to Reasonably Fit. We are so excited to have you here. And when you interviewed us for the Prehab Guys podcast, you led off with such a wonderful story about how when you were playing football when you were younger, you were on the smaller side and you were told that you were going to have a lot of limitations because of your size. And you went on to prove them wrong and you went on to have to lead the high school in tackles and do things that maybe a smaller football player might not be expected to do. And you related that to our mission and sort of one of the big principles we have here about how fitness doesn't have a look and that you can do things that aren't necessarily expected of you as long as you kind of like put in the effort. And so we loved that story. And so I wanted to sort of return the favor and share a story of something that I've experienced that relates to what you do. When I was younger, I was a gymnast, so that was my sport. And when I was about 12, I experienced an injury that I had to have surgery on both feet, both ankles, and I had casts up to my knees for like 3 months. And so what I did in that time is I was kind of devastated, right, that I couldn't compete, but the one thing I could do was show up to practice and do handstands. And so that was all I did. For 3 months, I just did handstands. I was like, this is the literally only thing I can do. And so fast forward to the next year, competition season comes around. I'm not having a great season. I'm a little bit still recovering from my injury. But one meet, it was like a Northeast championship meet. They said, oh, we're going to have a handstand competition with all of the teams, every single person who's here. And every team individually did a handstand competition within their own team. And then they sent one representative out to have a handstand competition with the entire Northeast region. And then they would announce this handstand champion. And I was like, this is literally my moment. Like, this is what I've been training for the last 3 months. Wow. I went through this horrible injury. I've had kind of a lot of roadblocks along the way, and I ended up being crowned handstand champion at this meet because of that injury. And so it is a perfect segue into what you've been talking about, what you're doing with your book, and what your mission is about hope, not nope, and being able to view injuries or setbacks as a potential for something better to arise. I was getting a little bit choked up and like emotional about that.
I'm getting choked up because that's what Hope Not Nope is about. And I'm so excited to be on this podcast with you because it's both what you're doing in the fitness space. And I know from the message that you guys share with people that you wouldn't be able to share it in the way that you do if you hadn't faced your own adversity. And when we face adversity, we get the choice. Right? Am I going to give up gymnastics? Am I just going to say, you know what? I've had these two surgeries, this thing that's super meaningful to me, it's not meant for me anymore. So I'm not going to do it. Or do we take that opportunity to say, wow, I get to gain some perspective right now. I have this injury. It's forcing me to slow down. It's forcing me to potentially work on some weaker areas. But I still get to be part of this thing that gives me meaning and gives me fulfillment. I think especially when we look at youth athletes, you know, when a kiddo has an injury and they're not allowed to be in their sport anymore, that's their friend group. That's their coping is being there. So they're not just losing that sport, but they feel like they're losing their friends. So it's so important that when people are given this message of nope, that they are given the complete story, that you can still show up and you're still part of the team and you don't know why you're going through this thing. Retrospectively, it's going to make sense when you have that handstand trophy and the team's lifting you up because you've worked on nothing but handstands for 3 months.
Exactly. And I think that's such an amazing message to be putting out there because it can be really devastating, especially if you're an athlete. I mean, it's so hard to go through an injury, pain, experience something that's setting you back, making you feel like you can't keep up with your teammates. And to know that they're is potentially something positive, a silver lining on the other side is so beneficial. And can you talk to us a little bit about how there's actually been research about like how your brain works and how you actually are internalizing your own pain, your own injury, and how that can actually lead to better results?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll start by saying that it's a continuous learning process. I remember graduating with my doctorate and starting off working as a clinician, and I was like, okay, I think I have the nervous system figured out. And I'll admit, I remember being in class and the professor, our neuro professor, who was phenomenal, she goes, every patient, every client is a neuro client. And I was like, well, then this is not the profession for me because I want to work in sports and I want to be in orthopedics. So like neuro, don't need it. And about a year into the education and into clinical rotations, I was like, wow, this is all neuro. Every injury, there's a neural component to it. And there's really good research from Dusty Grom showing that, for example, like an ACL injury, that the brain actually changes with having an ACL injury. But anyway, I learned about the brain and I'm on my first job and I'm working, and I started following Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett, who wrote How Emotions Are Made and 7.5 Lessons about the Brain. And I remember reading about two chapters of her book and going, oh my gosh, everything I've learned is a lie. And that's drastic. It wasn't a lie, but it wasn't the full story. Because she goes on to say that, yes, we have different parts of the brain. The common belief is that we have the triune brain and that we have this like animal and lizard brain that we're not able to control. So we tend to use that almost as an excuse of like, that's why I reacted that way, because my lizard brain was in control. And the reality is like, no, we have a much higher processing center that we get to choose how we're going to react to or how we're going to respond to these situations. So the way that the brain works is by prediction. And it's really fascinating once you start to learn how it works by prediction. The leading theory right now is the Bayesian prediction model. And basically what it says is that the input that comes in, because our nervous system, it's collecting data. Like our brain, it's the 3-pound heavyweight champion of the world. It takes in all this data, it processes it, and then it decides on what that output's going to be. So where does this input come from? It comes from the environment. I love the quote from James Clear in Atomic Habits, who states that environment's the invisible hand that shapes behavior. Because when we look at our environments, that's what sets us up for success or potential setbacks. So environment plays a big role. What our sensory system is taking in, that plays a role. So for example, people that have had like a joint replacement there, I can feel the weather changing. There's rain coming on. Well, there's baroreceptors inside of our nervous system that are picking up pressure changes in the environment, and then our brain is interpreting of what is actually happening there. So environment, what the sensory system is taking on. And then a huge component is your belief system. What are your previous memories? What have you been told? What's your education on this particular type of topic? Example I can give here is that people will think that they're destined to have a bad back because their mom or dad had a bad back or their great uncle had a bad back. So when they experience their first back injury, which is completely normal, like you're not going to go through this life without having a backache at some point in your life. It's going to happen. But the difference is that person that's been given that belief system that our family has bad backs, the first time that they have a bad back, that's now evidence as to why their back is bad. So now if they start believing that, their output and their behavior is going to change to really protect the back and not live the life that they were supposed to be living because of the fear that's been built up, but all from the prediction system. So it really gets into the nervous system when we have injuries of how can we change that prediction? And a lot of times it's changing the prediction by graded exposure, showing the person that it is okay for you to lift this weight. Maybe you hurt your back doing a deadlift, and then it gets into a different conversation. But the question I posed to that was it really the deadlift? Because how many times have you deadlifted in your life? Why was that one rep the one that created the discomfort? What else was happening in your life? What type of relationship changes? What type of career changes? Were you having a terrible day? Were you on 2 to 3 hours of sleep on 4 cups of coffee, trying to grind out this workout, and then the injury happened? Because there's a lot of things that we can work on in there to then change that prediction of what your output or what your outcome is going to be. Your outcome is not going to be that you need to avoid deadlifts the rest of your life because your back's going to explode if you lift this weight. It's let's take care of all those factors that are leading to the prediction that's creating that output.
I love that so much. That's so helpful for people to hear because it is so easy to try to, and it's probably something that we need to do in order to like cope with whatever might have happened, but try to place the blame on something. And it's easy to say, well, I was doing this, so that's the thing I can't do anymore. And so that can keep people from then participating anymore. They think that that was the one factor. And so just to zoom out and take a step back and say, what else could have been going on? And to give that equal weight, because I think it's hard to say like, well, yeah, I wasn't sleeping well, but it was clearly the deadlift. Like, obviously that's the thing. That's the moment that I felt it. So to really understand that it should have equal weight and we should really look at all the factors is super helpful.
Yeah. One of the cool things about the book that really kind of piqued our interest was, you know, if you hear about a book from a physical therapist, you're going to naturally assume like, okay, here are some exercises to fix your knee pain. Here are some exercises to fix your back. You kind of assume that it's going to be like almost an anthology of exercises, maybe some ways to self-assess and things like that. But this really dives much deeper into mindset and empowerment and just different strategies overall that are happening way before than this injury or pain is taking place in the first place. And so the way your book talks about environment and predictive processing and all that is just really helpful. And also not in a way of just like it's all in your head or cliche phrases to get out of it, but like really breaking down exactly why these things are happening in your brain, in your nervous system. And it's really a refreshing approach to this because ultimately this is the foundation of it all, right? You can't just slap on some rotator cuff exercises on top of a shoulder injury and expect it to completely go away overnight. There's a lot more things that need to go on with it. Now, I imagine that once you were out of PT school, there were a lot of just like influences and information out there of just like the best exercises and stuff like that. And I'm sure you probably ran into patients or clients where you're like, you know, this isn't really working. And you mentioned that that book you read that kind of revolutionized some things. Like, walk me through you getting out of PT school and just kind of reshaping your approach to this more hope, not nope sort of mindset foundational approach that you developed.
For sure. I owe it all to my mentor, Dr. David Boylan. He really took me under his wing and gave me a new perspective, because starting even before PT school, I started off at junior college and became a physical therapist assistant. And in PTA school, you learn a lot in those 2 years, but the biggest thing that you learn is that you are here to do modalities. And if people are wondering what modalities are, this is like ultrasound, electrical stimulation, heat packs, cold packs, like all the things that you're basically laying on the table and they're being done to you or for you. So I learned those things and I started working as a PT assistant. And I wasn't given the full story of that. A lot of these things are only working due to placebo, which is just the belief system that we're giving people. So quick example of that with ultrasound, for example, we were taught when you're doing this on someone, explain to them that we're using sound waves to create mechanotransduction, which then creates cellular healing. So to anyone, that sounds fascinating. Like, sign me up for that. Yeah, like you put gel on this thing, you're rubbing this wand on me, I get to lay here, like, lay this is great. So the PT I was working under, we did ultrasounds like almost on every patient. And I remember one day I was doing ultrasound and I was doing it on one patient's foot on the right side. And then they set me up to do it on the left side. So I'm doing ultrasound on both people's feet. And I'm thinking, like, I'm the best PT assistant in the world. I'm helping these two people get out of pain at the same time. This is efficient. I'm doing such a great job. Pat on the back. And we get done. I look at the machine on the left, and the PT that set it up, they never turned it on. So I'm basically just rubbing a wand. There's no sound waves going through. Nothing's happening. And both patients go, wow, thank you so much. I feel great. And I remember sitting there in the chair and I'm like, okay. And I go to write the note and I'm like, how do they both feel great when one actually got the treatment, one didn't get the treatment? And I'll admit, like, it was a mistake that kind of led to the revelation of like, oh, this isn't the answer. Like, there's more to this than what this thing is given. So reflected on that. And at the same time, I was in PT school, where we started getting more into how do you evaluate research? How do you look at and see what is the best research? And it's cool, but it's kind of scary when you learn that of like, people can adjust the numbers to create a p-value to make something look significant that's not significant. Mm. So how do you look through the method section? How do you look through the way that the study was set up to say that this was the effect that caused that? But anyway, as I'm going through PT school, we keep getting the message that we need to treat people as a whole system, which I'm like, yes, like, this is what I've been looking for, like treating people as human beings, not as a rotator cuff injury, not as a knee injury, but as Jason and as Lauren Pack and not their diagnosis. Yet our entire learning was broken down joint by joint. So here's the shoulder, here's the elbow, here's the hand and wrist, but we never really put it back together. I got pretty burnt out at that time. And I started working as a CrossFit coach because I didn't want to do ultrasounds anymore and was like, this is much more fulfilling. Love the community aspect, love coaching, loving just people that were ambitious to make changes in their life. Like, they're there for an hour workout, but they're there for an hour workout to make the next 23 hours of that day that much better. So it was really cool being with those people. And I had the thought of, why am I in PT school? Like, I can just coach CrossFit and really enjoy my life doing that. And it was right around the time we're picking our next clinical. And our professor goes, all right, there's this clinic. It was owned by Dr. David Boylan at the time, my mentor. And they're like, the best thing we can say about this clinic is that it's different. I had the third pick. So I raised my hand. I'm like, please sign me up for that clinic that's different because I need something that's different to kind of get through this. And I get down to the clinic. I remember walking in the first day. And I couldn't tell if this person was there for a foot injury. I couldn't tell if they're there for a shoulder injury. I couldn't tell really who was a patient and who wasn't because of just the environment that was created there. So it immediately kind of caught my attention, and I was really fascinated by it. And the best way to describe it is that Dr. David Boylan said, we're the clinic for the misfits. We're the clinics that the person has gotten to the end of the line of healthcare. They've done a bunch of imaging. They've done injections. They've done this. They've done that. They're at their wit's end. They need a solution. And the healthcare field is going, we don't really have anything left for you. Why don't you go ahead and go try out this clinic? So in there, I worked there for about 3 years. I really got to be with people and hear their stories and hear the suffering that they went through and all the complexity that was added to their lives because of these labels that were placed on them. And it was great. I loved being with those people, but part of me started to get really angry with what they were being told and that they were being sold these lies, because often, like, people think, oh, they're at the end of the line, so they went to this clinic. You guys probably had the best technology, probably had all these. No, we did the simplest things. Tell me your story. I want to hear about what led you to this point. Tell me your belief system. Now tell me where you want to go. What is the things that you want to do? And how do we start to actually get there? And I remember people would come in and they'd be kind of like, huh, this isn't what I was expecting. And it's like, exactly, because what you have been expecting has not led you to where you want to be. But anyway, working with a lot of these patients, it really fired me up. And I started to journal just to not be as angry and to just let it go, so that the next day I could try to show up as my best self for each person I was working with. And then I realized I was getting into the cycle of complaining, but without providing a solution. And when I realized that I'm not adding to the solution just by complaining, I need to do more to help people out there, because I don't want people to get to the end of the line anymore. I don't want them to go through 10, 20, 30, 40 years of suffering to find out a simple solution that could have been available to them before they ever got imaging done, before they ever went to the medical side of things. And so the book kind of started to form itself in that mission. But I know that I wouldn't have had that perspective had I not have had that revelation with the ultrasound, and had I not sought out something that was different and to learn more. And to your question too, Jason, about with exercises, the thing I started to learn with exercise is that I think exercise really matters for performance. I think if you want to improve your vertical, it really matters what we're doing. It matters that you have a baseline of strength. It matters that you're working and creating vertical forces and being efficient with vertical forces. What I found and what the research has shown is that when someone's in pain, it matters that they move, but the exact exercise may not actually be as important as we once thought it was. Mm. So I remember learning that and just going, well, then what's creating the outcome? Because if someone's in pain, they can do an exercise and get out of pain. They can have a modality done and get out of pain. They can do all these things and get out of pain. So really what's happening, and I think what's happening, is when people are in pain, they're uncertain, they're scared, because it's not just the pain response, but it's, can I continue to do this activity? Can I continue to go on my morning runs? Can I continue to lift boxes in the warehouse and provide meals for my family? Can I afford this payment? So it's not just this injury, but it's the person's livelihood. So they're in fear. They have all this uncertainty. The biggest thing that the person in pain is asking for is for some certainty. Can you guide me that I'm not stuck with this thing? Can you tell me that everything is going to be okay? And can you provide me with a plan that's going to get me there? And if they have confidence in that plan, I remember this one football coach used to say, it doesn't matter the playbooks that I write or the plays that I make. If the team is bought into it, they're going to execute that play to the best that it can be done, and we're going to move forward. In there. So I think when it comes to pain, that's the thing, is how can we provide certainty? How do we decrease fear and create safety for that person? And then how do we establish a plan that they can actually carry out to get to that outcome that they want to be? Because at the end of the day, if we get them back to where they were at, we have failed them in their rehab and in the prehab. We want to get them better. We want to blow their expectations that you came in with, let's say, the shoulder pain. You never thought you're going to throw a baseball again. And 2 months from now, you're throwing that baseball with your kid. And they're like, no, I can't do that. I blew out my shoulder when I was 20. And then, 2 months later, you get a text message. hey, I just picked up the baseball for the first time. Man, I'm a little sore, but that was great.
Yeah. Oh, that's the best that's feeling. Awesome.
Now, speaking of, you're talking about how people are uncertain. And oftentimes I feel like you talk to people who are in pain and they're just like, I just want to know what's wrong with me. And you go into this thing of like, well, let's do some imaging. Let's do some diagnostics. Let's do some assessments. And then you get maybe a diagnosis of some sort or a label. And in the book, you talk about how labels can be both helpful, but also harmful as well. Can you talk about and just elaborate on that topic?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up. I don't know if you're allowed to have a favorite chapter as an author. It's like, I'm sure it's like when you have kids, you're not allowed to have like a favorite kid. But I do have a favorite chapter. And I think that labels chapter is one of my favorites, because when I was reflecting on labels, at first I was on the one side of it, of that labels are only harmful. But then I realized, like, no, labels are actually really helpful, right? Like, don't dive into the shallow end of a pool because you're going to get injured. So labels can help protect us when we're not able to protect ourselves, because we're humans and sometimes we're going to do some things that we shouldn't be doing. So labels can really help us in that scenario. Labels can also become harmful if not given the full context of what this label means. So I completely agree. When people are uncertain, they want to know, what is this thing? And if I'm given a diagnosis, it makes it easier for me to have communication with other people that I have a rotator cuff tear, I have a whatever pathology it may be, then people understand it. And they also can empathize a little bit more, because then they're not thinking that, oh, okay, you're not making this up. There's actually something that's creating this, when the reality is that you're never making it up. Pain is always a real response. It's just figuring out what's the trigger that has caused that. But the harm with labeling is when people decide that that label is the thing that's going to dictate their life. And I'll give an example here. We're talking on the shoulder, so we'll stick with the shoulder. So a person has shoulder pain and they go into get it checked out because they want to know what's happening with this. The most common test that's done is the empty can test. So you lift your arm up, you turn your thumb down, and the provider pushes on your arm and you hold it there. You hold it there, and if there's pain, the provider says, you have a rotator cuff injury. Some will say you have a rotator cuff tear. Let's go get imaging done. So now the person goes and gets imaging done. The imaging may show that there is a rotator cuff tear. And then the provider says, yeah, there's a tear there. You're probably going to need surgery, but go ahead and go try PT. And then we'll see what happens. So now the person's coming into physical therapy with the mindset that they're doomed and they're going to need surgery no matter what. So then we're trying to reverse that process and give them the complete story of that label, because that test, that empty can test, when a person lifts their arm and they're holding that there and the provider's pushing down on the end of that arm, there's 9 other muscles that are equally active as the rotator cuff. So any of those other 9 muscles could be where a muscle strain could potentially be. So we cannot conclude from that test that it's a rotator cuff injury. There's other muscles that are involved. And then the imaging part, there's this really cool research done though where they did ultrasound imaging, not the treatment, but like the actual like picture using ultrasound. And they found that in the middle-aged population, that 96% of the subjects showed abnormalities in their rotator cuff, but were completely asymptomatic. Mm. They had no pain, no discomfort, and no loss of function. And then other studies in the MLB have shown that 91% of pitchers have a torn rotator cuff, 89% of pitchers have a torn labrum. They have no pain. They are doing the most aggressive, violent motion that the shoulder can do, and they're functioning with no pain. So the question then becomes, well, what happens when the person's given that label and they're given this test and they had a respected figure that told them that this thing is torn, but they're not given that other side that, hey, your rotator cuff is torn, so is 96% of other people. Mm-hmm. And you can have this thing operated on and it can tear again within 2 years. You'll never know, and you'll still be functioning at high levels, because the outcome is not due to the rotator cuff still being attached. It's due to the function that you gain back and the decreased pain that you've had. But what ends up happening is people get this label and they get afraid because they know someone that's had a rotator cuff injury and their rehab didn't go well and they had surgery and they're still only able to lift to about 90 degrees of shoulder flexion. So now their brain starts predicting that that's the outcome. And that's where the label becomes harmful. I think the biggest thing that people can take away from that is that never forget that we have a choice. We have the choice to decide what labels are going to serve us and what labels that we want to get rid of. Because if society is good at one thing, it's really good at putting labels on people. You know, like I was told I was too small to play football. At a young age, I was told that like I had dyslexia and had some speech things. And so the fact that I like host a podcast and wrote a book, that was because I ripped that label off. I was like, I'm not going to let that label dictate how I live my life and what I do. I'm going to persevere through that. So if you're listening, never forget that you have that choice to rip off that label. Whoever put it on you, you know, you don't have to be angry at them, but you get to decide what your outcome is going to be. And as you start doing that, that label will change.
That's so great. I want that to be like on repeat of my own brain for forever, because it's just so helpful. I mean, we've all been in the situations where we have been given some sort of information about ourselves, and we start to internalize that as something that we have to now live by, we have to identify by, and to be able to have a different perspective and just be able to say, like, that doesn't have to be my reality. I can choose my reality. That's so powerful. So powerful. I actually want to give you, I gave you a little Easter egg before we started the interview of, you asked me how I'm doing, and I said, I'll let you know during the interview because I didn't want to tell you right off the bat, but we've talked about football. I play football in a competitive, like a contact flag football league for in a women's league. And over Memorial Day weekend, I had a tournament in Philadelphia. Whole family went down. I had three games the first day, three games the second day. So in my second game, Jason wasn't even there yet with the kids. They were on their way over. I was playing defense, went up to try to make a pick or at least bat down a ball. The girl and I collided in the air. I came down on top of her. Apparently, she kind of curled up in a ball on the ground, and I came down right on top of her knee. So her knee went right into my lower back. And immediately, I couldn't move. I had to kind of like rolled onto, I somehow got onto all fours, and my back was completely spasming. I couldn't move my legs. Immediate panic of like, what was that injury? What even just happened? Finally, teammates kind of got me up off the ground, walked me over to the tent where there was an AT. And he slapped some ice on it for 20 minutes, came over, asked me to lift my legs. I could kind of barely lift them. And he was like, okay, you should go to urgent care and get some imaging. And gave me really nothing else. No other advice, no other form of comfort. Like, just go get some imaging. And because I've, you know, heard from people like you, and I've had other PTs in my life who have said, like, you know, this isn't always, like, just going to get imaging isn't always the first thing you might want to do, because there might be stuff going on, like you said, that isn't related to this injury. Like, we don't really know what just happened. I don't have footage of it. I don't know exactly where that knee went into my back, and if imaging would show something unrelated to the injury, right? So I didn't go and get imaging right away. And this was only 5 days ago now. So I'm still working my way through just being comfortably able to sit in a chair. I'm still kind of just getting some movement back in my spine and kind of figuring things out. Anyway, so that being said, if I were to come to you today and say, this is what's been going on, and my fears are, I'm not going to be able to play football this weekend, or maybe next weekend, or maybe in my tournament in Chicago next month, I'm really afraid that I'm not going to be able to move in the same way anymore, I'm afraid this might be a long-term injury, I have all of these fears, and I'm afraid to also get imaging, because I'm afraid to know if something's more seriously wrong than I want to believe. Does that make sense? What would your just kind of initial conversation with me be? We can have it in real life.
Absolutely. I mean, first, I would want to comment that I love seeing the posts with you playing football, because it provides so much hope. And it shows that you can be busy, you can run a business, you can be a mom, and you can still do things that are super meaningful to you as an athlete, that you don't have to give up this athlete lifestyle because you have these other buckets that are going on in your life. And you just demonstrating that and leading from the front by doing the activity, I think is incredible. Well, I think the second thing that I would do, it's hard to do it virtually, but before we got into further conversation, I'd put a football right in your lap, and I'd ask you to hold on to that football throughout the rest of the conversation. Because what that will do is, now I don't have to say that you're going to get back to football. Because if you weren't going to, I wouldn't have put the football in your lap in the first place. Like, if you came in and you had no feeling, reflexes were gone, and were thinking that, you know, I don't know if there's going to be movement back, not going to wave the steak in front of the lion's face. Right. But with this, you're already improving. You're already getting better. I'm putting the football in your lap and having you hold on to that, because that's going to start to change your prediction. Because you're wondering, am I going to be able to play football again? Why the heck did they just put a football in my lap and we haven't even got into the full conversation? So we can start using the environment to start shifting the behavior and the mindset immediately before we get into further conversation.
I love that.
The next thing I would ask before we get into more of the back injury would be, well, why do you play football? Like, what does football do for you? Like, what's that why behind it? Which I am interested, Lauren. So why do you play football?
Yeah, honestly, it is because it's something that makes me feel like myself, even though I have so many other things going on. Like, this is something for me, and I'm competitive, and I really like to prove people wrong. So for the most part, for me, it's like I was a gymnast. Like, I shouldn't be playing in a contact sport. Like, that wasn't even my background, but I love to be able to show that I can do something unexpected and I could be athletic. And so it's sort of a blend of having time for myself, doing something that I love, but also having that little like chip on my shoulder that I want to prove that I can do something that people don't think I could do.
Oh, I love that. And then as our role as providers, it's figuring out, how do we allow that to be back in your life? How do we allow you to get back to that thing? So what I would say is that as your back and your body's healing itself, what I want you to do is I want you to keep your conditioning up, and I want you to keep strength going in other areas of your body. Because one, in doing that, growth hormone, IGF-1's pumping throughout your body, which is going to help the healing process. And second, when you get back to the game, you don't want to be out of breath. Like, you don't want to lose the conditioning that you've built up. If it's painful to run right now, what I want you to do is get on the bike, and don't get on the bike and just pedal around for half an hour, just looking around lazily. But if you have game film, pull up your game film and watch yourself. Whenever you sprint, I want you to sprint on that bike. Whenever you're jogging, I want you to jog on that bike. Whenever you're resting, go ahead and rest on that bike. But watch yourself playing that game, match the intensity of the conditioning to what you're doing. And the reason we're going to do that is because, again, we're changing the prediction of the brain. The brain is saying, I'm trying to protect. I'm trying to keep you from doing these things because I'm not sure if it's safe. But now you're getting a visual cue that it is safe, and you're getting a cardiovascular demand that's similar to that sport. So now, working off a prediction, the brain's going, oh, wait, we're working at that intensity and my back isn't seizing on me. So this is okay. The next part of the conversation I would get into is that we want to understand the injury a little bit more, because it's fascinating in football. And I'll share some quick research with you to demonstrate this point. But one of the reasons that we have a pain response is when we predict something, but then something unpredictable happens and our brain isn't able to process it in that moment. Mm. So then it creates the pain response. It locks these muscles up until it can figure out what happened and are things okay. Really fascinating research on concussions in football, that they put helmet sensors in the helmets, and they just followed and they looked at impact forces and what caused a concussion. So we know that impact forces are needed for concussions. But what was interesting from the research is that some of the greatest head forces were after a touchdown was scored, because teammates headbutt each other.
Yeah.
But when they headbutt each other, it's a social construct of bonding. It's a social construct of achievement and success and brotherhood. So they had these high impacts, but they didn't have concussions. Mm. Yet a player that's going across the middle, jumping for a ball that gets hit, when they don't know a hit is coming, they will experience a concussion. So I'm sure that the injury that happened was that your brain didn't know what was happening.
Right.
You jumped up to get this ball, and you came down and something hit in a weird area, and it's trying to figure it all out. It wasn't a social construct of bonding. Like, you weren't going up with that girl to be her best friend. You were going up to pick the ball. So, the intention matters around the injury, and how it happens matters as well. So from that, we have a better understanding of, oh, this is why my back locked up on me. This is why it was sore. This is why it was hard for me to get back in. So the next part we would then get into is like, well, what movements are you able to do right now? Like, you mentioned that things are starting to get a little bit better, you're starting to get some movement back. So like, what's your current level of function right now? Are we able to do body weight movements? Are we able to do agility drills? Are we able to do cuts? And then we would reverse engineer the program back from, okay, this happened on defense, so let's do back pedals, let's do cuts, let's do aggressive coming up three steps, stop and going back. Can you twist around? Can you do all these things that make you not just back in the game, but really good in the game? And then the last step would be, and this one kind of sounds funny and I'll share a quick story with it, but I want you to fall again. Mm-hmm. I need you to fall again on the turf or on the grass, whatever playing field it was on. I need you to have that experience again, because the brain needs to see that, okay, this one time I dove and I landed and it hurt my back, and it starts to forget the millions of other times that you've done that. Especially as a gymnast growing up, I'm sure you've fallen on your back so many times.
Right.
But the brain tends to forget those ones that have happened, and it remembers the one that created the pain response. So before you get back out onto the field, I want you to have that experience in a safe environment to show your brain that it is okay and that you are able to tolerate these forces. I worked with this one lacrosse athlete, and she got back for her last like playoff game. It was her senior game, and she was coming back from a knee injury, and I told her, you're going to go to make a cut in the game. When you go to make a cut, you're going to hear a pop, and it's okay because your knee has done that before thousands of times, but the last time it did it, your ACL tore. So now your brain has remembered that popping in my knee during competition means that my ACL is torn. I'm like, so what I want you to do is, that's going to happen. Your brain's going to freak out. You're going to be on the turf. You're going to be having a panic attack. And what I want you to do is look at your knee. And I want you to see, is there swelling? If there's no swelling, I want you to move your leg back and forth. Move it back and forth. If you can do that, I want you to contract your quad. If you can contract your quad, I want you to stand up. If you can stand up, I want you to walk. If you can walk, I want you to run. And if you can do all those things, you're fine.
Yeah.
Keep playing. You're changing the prediction in your brain. So all of those things happened. And I remember being on the sidelines, and her goggles are turned sideways on her face. She has like the rubber turf dripping down her cheeks. She's crying, but she went through the whole process, and she just gives me a thumbs up and like waves the trainer and the coach off and like kept playing. And so it's important that athletes are known that this is how the prediction works. And if this experience happens, here's how you can take control to have a response versus reacting to it. Now, typically, by the time we get to the end of the conversation, the question that the person had on imaging is no longer there, because they're like, oh, I don't want to pursue that anyway. I got something better that I want to get after. If the person is still very much wondering about imaging, I would ask, why? Like, why do you want to have that imaging done? Like, what does that image do for you? You know, my mentor used to always say, imagine going to a psychologist with a picture of your family, and you say, my family's crazy. Look at this picture. Can you help them? Like, with this still picture, what are we going to do with that information? We need to see that thing moving in its environment to know how to treat it. And kind of last point here I'll say is that one struggle that I've had is specifically in rugby, but I know that it happens in other sports, but rugby is a sport in which athletes do not retire because they don't want to play anymore. They don't retire because their body isn't able to withstand the forces anymore. It's a sport that you only retire from if you've had a massive injury. Like, it's just the culture that this group has. So I remember working with one guy, and he was thinking about getting imaging done and a surgery done, and I kept pushing back against him of like, the evidence isn't there, the data's not showing that it's needed, but that athlete went and had it done, and they retired, and the whole next season, oh, you're not playing anymore? Well, yeah, I can't play anymore because of the surgery that I had. And I realized that surgery was a means to an end. Mm. That surgery gave him what he needed in his society to be able to say, yeah, I can't participate in the sport anymore.
Yeah.
So if a person is constantly wanting to get imaging or constantly is pushing that, I think I need that surgery, and we have a lot of data showing that it's not needed, well, there's something else that's pressing them towards that. And I've learned that we need to respect that and honor that, even though we don't agree with it.
Wow.
Wow.
That was a masterclass. My back feels better already. I'm not even lying.
Well, that's the benefit of it, is that when people are coming to see you, or when people pick up the book, my hope is that they feel empowered. They feel that they can persevere. They feel that they're not frail, they're not fragile, they're not broken. That, yes, this thing happened to you, but you can get back to where you want to be by taking those right steps. And usually by the end of the conversation, people are feeling better. And a lot of these other questions start to go away. Where if you go at it from the other side of, okay, you're coming in, tell me, first thing, tell me about the back. Tell me about your back. Like no. Tell me about you first, because your back is part of you. I talk about it in the book, but it's funny that people tend to dissociate their injured part from their body. Mm. So it's like, Lauren, how's your back doing? Oh yeah, it's sore. It's not doing great. How are you doing? Oh, I'm doing great. It's like, well, how can that happen? Like, why is that dissociated? And so a lot of times people end up feeling better after a chapter or after going through the evaluation. And my mentor jokes around that I'm recovering PT, because I typically see people like once a month, once every 2 months, once every 6 months, once every year, instead of 2 to 3 times a week, because they get the things that they need and they're empowered to go take control of it. And so that's what it's about. At least to me, I'd rather have people out doing the things that they love opposed to being in the office.
Yeah. Well, I fully wholeheartedly believe that you're accomplishing that, because that was really, really beautiful. I mean, really amazingly, like I didn't give you a heads up on what that question was going to be. And you just, I mean, that was mind blowing. Yeah. That was really, really amazing. So thank you, Dylan. I think that everyone listening has had some sort of similar situation where they go through those thoughts and they go through those fears. And so to even be able to, if we have that experience in the future, even be able to say, like, what would Dylan ask? Like, you know, like try to bring ourselves back to the reality of the situation, not so focused on that one area of the body that's hurting, but overall reality of what's going on in your life and how we can move forward. It's so powerful and so helpful. So thank you so much for myself and for everyone listening. Can you give us a little information on where people can buy the book, where they can follow you, how they can learn more from you?
Yeah, absolutely. So Instagram is @hopenotnope. We have a website, hopenotnope.org. The information for the book is on there. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Nobles. There's physical copy, Kindle, and audiobook that are all available. And I actually have some links that I'm able to share. So if you're listening and you'd like a copy of the audiobook, the first 3 people that DM me Hope Not Nope on Instagram, I'll provide you with the link so that you can listen to the book, because the goal is to get the book out to as many people. And I love being on the podcast, and I want to gift that to the audience.
Oh, that's so nice of you. That's awesome. Thank you. And we'll link all of the, your Instagram and the book in our show notes as well. So thank you so much again for being on with us. We had such a great interview with you when you interviewed us for the Prehab Guys podcast, and we knew we wanted to have you on as well. You're so well-spoken and so knowledgeable. So we really appreciate you. Thank you, Dylan.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.